Mrs. Bam.
Thank you. So we'll call the subcommittee to order. We're running late today. The House session went late. I appreciate the indulgence of all the people from the Attorney General's office and allowing the members to eat a little get a little sustenance for the afternoon, even though we probably don't need it, but that's all right. Byron, we had left off yesterday with you and the Criminal Justice Division, and I think we'll just start from there.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I did leave off, and I just finished up the tobacco portion, and I was picking up on the area dealing with criminal intelligence. Our criminal intelligence unit the mission of that particular unit is set up to predict and pinpoint organized criminal activity. The idea behind that is to allow law enforcement agencies to make a priority as to their activity and also to allocate resources. We feel that that's the most effective way for an intelligence, criminal intelligence unit to work. We have something unique about it. We have an attorney that's assigned to that particular unit, and that is something that's been touted throughout the intelligence community as something that's been unique. It ensures that the operation of our criminal intelligence unit is conducted within the law. It assures that. There's one aspect of this is the high-intensity drug trafficking area. This particular funding is through federal funds. It involves seven counties, and that particular high-intensity drug trafficking area has been one that is focused in drug trafficking areas and in particular locations. It's set by the Office of National Drug Control Policy out of Washington, D.C. We have seven counties. We initially started with three. The three counties were Jackson, Deschutes, and Marion counties. We now have Douglas County. We have Washington County, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties. They've been designated as what we call HIDA counties, or the intensity area for drug activity that to focus in on. Those are federal funds, but they focus on the criminal intelligence dealing only with drugs. They do not involve other criminal activity. And we know as well as everyone else that criminal activity and drugs is a problem throughout the state. But it also crosses lines, jurisdictional lines involving other crimes, and that's why the criminal intelligence unit becomes critical, because the criminal intelligence unit gathers information, collates information on all crimes throughout the state. And what we've done and what we've been successful at is integrating the criminal intelligence unit and this HIDA function together, so they operate as one group, because we know what's going on in criminal activity in Washington County. We know over in Yamhill County that we're talking about burglaries and things like that, and it's important to put that criminal intelligence information together. The next slide deals with the services, and I'll just briefly go through those. The analytical services is really the in-depth analysis that we provide, identifying, engaging the scope of criminal activity. We identify key individuals in the organization's structure. The deconfliction services, that's part of what we call our watch center, where we basically have case and event deconfliction. Case deconfliction is where we're talking about events that are happening, a crime happening in Multnomah County, and we have one happening over in Astoria. And it's basically that information is put together. They basically collate that information. Event deconfliction really involves those situations where you have different agencies working different cases, and all of a sudden you determine that, oh, in effect, you have search warrants, arrest warrants, surveillance, all happening at the same location. It's an officer safety issue, so that you don't have, as we see, all of a sudden search warrants and arrest warrants happening at one point, because they have agencies, different agencies and jurisdictions working on, maybe they end up working on the same case. I have a handout for you, because one of the things that we are involved in and includes the collection and dissemination of information, and it's a threat assessment. And to determine the scope of that, we collect that information, and to determine what the scope of organized crime would be. Just hand that to you. I won't go through that, but other than to point out that that information that I'm handing to you deals with the scope of some of the methamphetamine labs in the state of Oregon. And we provide that, obviously, to focus resources, to assist law enforcement. But in addition to that, it provides officer safety. And as you will see, the danger that's imposed upon law enforcement, in fact, when they go out to these methamphetamine sites, these labs, and some of the dangers that they are confronted with. The other thing that I want to talk about before I leave this intelligence area, and that relates to domestic terrorism. We know that there's a concern throughout the United States about international terrorism, but we have also concerns about domestic terrorism. We've been very fortunate in having the opportunity to work with the Oregon State Police in working on this domestic terrorism issue. We jointly monitor and investigate areas of domestic terrorism. We know that this particular area, if we talk about the Northwest being an area where there's a lot of white supremacy groups, we monitor those sorts of activities, the criminal activities that might be involved. I noticed in the newspaper today they were talking about Oklahoma and the bombing down in Oklahoma, and it's our concern about those sorts of things that could possibly happen. So we try and monitor activity and try and determine if, in fact, those things may occur. But I think one thing that we're seeing now and that hits all of us is really the eco-terrorism. We're talking about the animal liberation front and also the environmental liberation front. We talk about arsons and destruction of property in the investigation. I point those out because that encompasses domestic terrorism, and it's important for us to keep on top of and part of our intelligence function. We're also seeing anti-government criminal activity against public officials. That includes liens being filed against judges, district attorneys, police officers on property affecting their credit rating and things like that. We also see things that are filed with the IRS basically to affect public officials. And we have, because of our liaison work with the federal officials, trying to basically nip those things in the bud so that all of a sudden a public official doesn't determine that, hey, I've got a letter from IRS saying if I don't do a certain thing, I'm going to be investigated and potential penalties. I'll shift from this in criminal intelligence and talk just briefly about the Cooperative Disability Investigation Unit. This is a federal partnership that we have with the Office of the Inspector General, Social Security Administration. It's a federally funded program, and I guess the best way to describe that we all can identify with, it's that situation where somebody is getting disability benefits, and they go to the doctor, and they're in a wheelchair, and then after they leave, then they turn around and are out on the golf course playing golf. And it's basically they're defrauding the government. This particular program has been quite successful. The savings on the next chart talks about the period of time from October of 2001 to December of 2002. That's the length of time of the Department of Justice's participation in this particular program. As you can see from the chart, there's projected savings over a five-year period of time that relates to a considerable amount of money. There's $9 million just in non-Social Security savings, of which part of that includes $3 million that relate to the Oregon Health Plan. And on the previous slide, I had mentioned, and you saw up there where it talked about a gateway to state benefits, and the reason for that is once you qualify for Social Security benefits, you automatically qualify for state benefits. So if we can nip it in the bud in the early end, it's a benefit and a savings later on through the Oregon Health Plan. The next slide deals with our performance measures, and that is the percentage of Criminal Justice Division cases resolved successfully. The base period that we've used is July 1, 2001 to June 30 of 2002. Our success rate there as far as cases being resolved successfully is 98%. And when we talk about resolved successfully, we talk about cases that are closed by conviction, appropriate plea agreement, or investigation resulting in exonerating the person. But also included in that, a specialized request or service was closed by a satisfactory completion or resolution. That would cover those situations, as I mentioned to you yesterday, such as like Grant County, where we're asked to go in and administer the county because the district attorney is no longer in service, and we've been there for an 11-month period of time. The next slide deals with our open and active cases. It covers the scope of a first six quarters of 9901 and 0103. And you can see the increase in the open and active cases that we're involved in. I would also comment about the, as a workload measure, not only this, but also the average hours, the hours that are worked on by the attorneys in our office. Our average monthly hours billed per attorney is 21% over the standard hours billed for, which is would be expected of an attorney. And that obviously leads to issues. I think we push the envelope with respect to the number of hours and working on cases. It does have an effect on the attorney staff, and we've lost a couple of attorneys in large measure because of the burden of working on cases.
Byron, I think it's also important to point out here that this is just these are just cases. I mean, I can remember many, many times some of the DA's assistants where we just pick up the phone and ask for some direction on cases. So this doesn't count the
legal advice.
Just legal advice and phone calls.
It is. And it's around the clock, and that's a good point to mention. Just one other point. I say around the clock because the case over in Tillamook County, the Morris, where there's the people that have died, I had a phone call while I was in the mall down here. It was on the weekend because of a critical event that was happening to provide assistance to the district attorney over there during the course of a search and questioning. So it's that round the clock that we provide. That's not included, obviously, in this this stat. The other thing, the next item, is our policy package. It's 141. This really deals with the investigative and prosecutorial support to the Secretary of State's office. This is not general funds. It's another funded program. Basically, it's federal funds. It asks for one assistant attorney general and one criminal investigator. And the goal behind that is to successfully resolve cases requiring investigation and prosecution in a timely manner. The funding, as you can see, is passed through the Secretary of State's office, and it's to be phased in over the next biennium. And the timing and that sort of thing, I don't know, has really been determined at this point, but it would be phased in. And probably what's important is the next slide, which shows the open and active cases that we have in the first six quarters of 99-01 and 01-03. And the increase of cases that we have. Certainly the Attorney General, we have the responsibility to investigate those particular cases.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just relative to the prosecutorial support for the Secretary of State's office, Byron, I guess the concern I have is we've got kind of a litmus test that we're going to run on these that have federal support. And that litmus test includes, you know, how long these are going to be around, what kind of long-term support can we expect from the federal government, and then will these programs eventually have to be taken over from general funds? So those are issues that I would like to have Kelly and Doug work through if we could. No response necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. The next slide shows basically the counties that we are that we have cases that are open and active from the beginning of this biennium up until today. The other, going to the next slide, actually we just talk about the revenues by source for the Criminal Justice Division, and it obviously shows that there is a portion, 24%, is in fact general fund. The next slide deals with the Department of Justice, the governor's balanced budget, and the expenditures. Particular slide breaks it down. The next slide, and I know you've seen these slides, but the next one is expenditure history for the Department of Justice dealing with the governor's balanced budget as it relates to our particular budget. The next item is the expenditures by category, dealing with our funds. The next item is the essential packages, which is the inflation factor, and I know you've heard people talking about that in the past. If you need probably any other detailed information, Mr. Petcha may be able to, you know, address that. And I guess really what I want to end with is really the next three that deal with basically reductions. Obviously, the one deals with a third special session, and then there's the fifth special session, and then the House Bill 3182 reductions. A couple comments I want to make about that. I made the comment yesterday with respect to the budget reductions for 0305 and its impact. Certainly, one option, as I mentioned to you before, was the eliminating of DOJ funding for the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, $714,000, the necessity of having those three legs. That's a specialized area for us. It's not the core function or what we would end up doing as a unit. But if we look at other cuts, and district attorney assistants, and the core function that we do in organized crime, it is a core function of public safety. And what the impact would be in the reduction of resources would be a reduction in the hours of direct assistance to district attorneys and also to law enforcement agencies. That would equate into fewer cases that we would be able to prosecute or investigate in assisting district attorneys. That means curtailing assistance in murder cases, sex cases, and financial criminal investigation based on the resources that we have from our financial people. What's crucial, though, I think, in the greatest impact is that it's going to be on small and medium-sized counties. Those are the ones that are really going to feel it by a reduction of these particular services that we would need to do. Another area that we would curtail is the number of public corruption or official misconduct cases that we would be able to handle. And that would be across the board as it relates to the state. We would have to, the publications would be discontinued and certainly curtailing the basic training that we are able to do for prosecutors. Basically, what we're talking about is a reduction of hours, prosecutor hours and investigator hours. And unfortunately, too, in looking at this and the number of hours that would need to be curtailed, it would certainly reduce our investigative efforts dealing with domestic and eco-terrorism, the type of activity that we need to do to stay on top of that sort of thing. And without even addressing if we had another governor's directive to go in and run another DA's office because of resignation or whatever may happen, that we're directed to do that. And that would certainly have a drastic impact on the program. With that, I have no other comments unless there's any questions. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
I'm going to let Representative Hansen run the gavel. Representative Butler and I have to go next door and meet the co-chairs, but I certainly appreciate the presentation. I'm going to let Representative Hansen take it from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do want to say for the record, while Representative Butler's here, though, we did talk about accountant fraud yesterday.
And I appreciated your
excluding. He was out of the room, so I wanted to make sure that the chair.
Go ahead.
And as soon as he leaves again, we'll
talk about it. Talk about again.
Thank you.
But Mr. Acting Chair, this is not a good audience for jokes about attorneys. So
we'll stick with accounting. Quick question I had: when you stepped in to run a district attorney's office because of some level of vacancy, does the county reimburse you for that?
No, they do not. Because the district attorney is a state officer. And what is happening is the state officer is no longer present. So what we're doing is we're going in and filling the functions of that state officer. So it's not a county. It's not a county office in the sense of being funded. It's a state official who we're going in and supervising that particular office, although it does the county functions of that office. And to give you an impact, you know, we mentioned about cases that we have. We deal with major sophisticated cases, complex cases that we prosecute, and we look at the numbers of cases. And we look at, well, all right, we don't have a lot of numbers of cases, but they're major cases that we work on. But just one of those cases was dealing with Grant County. But if you look at Grant County and the number of cases that we handle there, just going in and doing that job, we're handling over 400 and some cases just in the daily activity of running that particular office. So when you look at our caseload and we say, well, okay, here's the number of these cases, but they're major cases, taking a lot of time. And one of those cases just happened to be going in and administering that office for 6 months. So, you know, that gives you somewhat of an idea of the workload. But no, there is no reimbursement because it's a state officer that we're going in and serving in that capacity.
Senator Devlin.
We often, I think, need to connect some of the dots in these discussions in terms of the criminal justice system, that it's multiple levels that are all dependent upon one another. And since I will have, or the committee will have, the state police up here sometime in the near future, and since you become involved in some of the more complex criminal cases, and plus become involved in the counties that may not have all the resources that maybe some of the more populous counties have, what's the impact that you see in terms of the loss of the regional labs and literally the probably more than a 50% reduction in the capability of the state lab?
Drastic. Terribly drastic. and I don't want to minimize this at all. I can't emphasize the importance of the crime labs. As a prosecutor for over 29 years, I can't tell you how critical those crime labs are and the service that's provided. I'll have to tell you it would be just like pulling the rug out from underneath prosecution if, in fact, there is the elimination of those crime labs. It's just a critical service. And not only the major counties, but you look in the smaller, medium-sized counties, we rely on those crime labs. And I know, as a former district attorney of a small county, when you had a major homicide, you had the crime lab come out processing the evidence. Because in those particular cases, I have to tell you, you make one critical mistake, you lose the case. And a person that committed murder walks. It's that crucial.
Along those same lines, since you would deal with cases in assistance, cases that are on appeal, those cases that were problematic in terms of their investigations, in terms of the treatment of forensic evidence, could probably be problematic for years to come, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't get your last part.
Those kinds of cases could be problematic for years to come. Just surmising that the person is still convicted, but you had very shoddy treatment of evidence, et cetera, and you get into the...
You know, and to comment about that is one of the problems that we have is that if you make mistakes at the front end, or you have shoddy investigation or inadequate investigation, it's going to cause you problems at the back end, which turn around, cases are appealed, reversed, and you go back and you end up retrying those cases.
Mr. Chairman, final question. I won't ask you the difficult question of if you could restore forensic personnel or state troopers, which would you do? I'll leave that to...
No question. Mr. Chair.
Any further comment?
Thank you very much.
Child support.
Okay. And now we move to child support.
Which should be under or in the booklet, I hope. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that the presenters explain the interesting relationship they have because actually Ms. Shinnok is actually a DHS employee temporarily and is to return, I think, to her position sometime after this session as the package is, the transfer is completed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Cindy Chinook, for the record, the Child Support Program Director, and I am on leave from Department of Justice and over at DHS for this interim year, this fiscal year, which is a transition year. You've heard earlier that there's a proposed consolidation of the program into the Department of Justice. I was the administrator of the Division of Child Support prior to taking the leave to go over to help with this transition. And in the meantime, Bob David, who is here, is the acting administrator of the Division of Child Support. So together we're partnering as the leadership to the program until we get through session to see if, in fact, the consolidation is approved. And then I would return to Department of Justice as the administrator of this division and director of the program. And Bob, actually, will start the presentation. So,
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob David, and I am the acting administrator of the Division of Child Support. I'd like to start our presentation by acquainting you with the Division of Child Support and talking a little bit about our mission. The Division of Child Support provides a public service that's focused on improving the well-being of children, and we do that by working to ensure that parents are financially responsible for their children. And while our core purpose is focusing on those financial needs, we also understand that children need more than just money from their parents. So while we're delivering the child support services, we're also working to promote an active involvement by both parents in their children's lives. This mission has changed over the years from one that was simply one to recover monies that were being paid out in the form of assistance to one that places priorities on children and on families and helping the families to be responsible for the children financially and support them emotionally as well. The Division of Child Support is aware of the importance of how we deliver child support services, and because of that, we place a very high value and priority on quality customer service. We are aware of what we say and what we do because we value integrity and ethical conduct. We also recognize that if we're going to be effective in the delivery of our mission, we have to partner with other people who can help us to meet that mission. So we work together to develop collaborative partnerships in the local communities in which we serve. We want to be a learning organization, so we work to grow as individuals and as a division. And we recognize the importance of meeting the public trust, so we work to achieve operational excellence. The goals that we've established for our divisions are really centered around the values that I just talked about. We want to ensure that children are adequately supported, so we work to increase the level of that support and the consistency of the child support payments that are necessary for these really fragile families to remain self-sufficient and less dependent on government services. We recognize that the real success lies in our ability to partner with resources within the communities so that we can refer our customers to those community services when they need help. The strength that we have in our division lies in our employees, and we continually work to improve and continue their development so that they serve the public well. We care about those that we serve, so we always want to improve the quality and the effectiveness of the child support services that we deliver. I want to talk a little about the child support program as a whole and give you a little background to it. The child support program was established in 1975 as a partnership between the federal, the state, and the local governments. It was originally designed, as I said before, to recover costs for the state and federal government. But since the late 1980s, the focus has shifted nationally to a more comprehensive approach to child support. The Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement provides oversight, funding, and technical assistance to the states. And under the current organization in Oregon, the Department of Human Services is responsible for the oversight of the child support program. The Department of Human Services contracts with the district attorneys to provide those child support services to non-assistance cases, and contracts with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support to provide child support services on cases where the children have received public assistance or currently are receiving public assistance. In addition, there are 8 district attorneys who contract with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support to work their non-assistance cases for them. The Division of Child Support has 16 offices that are located throughout the state, and 8 of those offices are co-located with our partners. We also provide program-wide services, such as receipting and the distribution and accounting for all child support program cases in Oregon. The Division of Child Support maintains the child support's automated system, maintains and publishes forms, procedures, and publications for the program. And currently, the program as a whole serves around 247,000 families. The Department of Human Services began transferring the responsibility for the child support program to the Department of Justice Division of Child Support in 1998. And the final phase of that transfer will transfer the director's responsibility to the Department of Justice. House Bill 2340, if passed, will transfer that responsibility for the director, positions, and funding to the Department of Justice. And later on in this presentation, Cindy will talk about the proposed consolidation of the program. The Division of Child Support is organized into 3 sections. And the State Operations Section is responsible for the delivery of those child support services in the local communities. The Program Assistance Section is responsible for the infrastructure for the program and serves both the Division of Child Support and the District Attorneys. The policy, rules, and legislative section is responsible for promulgating rules and policy and also for monitoring and implementing new federal mandates. The administrator of the division oversees the program performance and is also part of the Department of Justice's executive team. I want to talk a little about the case management philosophy. It is a goal of the Division of Child Support to have parents who are willing and able to pay their child support obligations. And many of our customers are both willing and able to pay, but unfortunately not all of those who are willing are able. Our case managers are trained to listen to the customers when we talk to them to identify the barriers that keep them from being able to meet their obligations. And this is where those collaborative partnerships that I talked about building are so very important. While we don't provide services that help remove barriers, we do refer our customers to our partners who can provide those services for them. And the things that we're talking about are helping them with improved job skills so that they can gain employment or get better employment. Many of them have substance abuse issues and mental health issues where our partners can assist them. Our goal is to take these people who are unable to pay child support, to put them into the category of being willing and able to pay. There are parents, as we all know, who are unwilling to pay child support. And our case managers have a wide variety of tools to compel payments when necessary, and I'll get to those specific ones in a few minutes. But again, our goal is to move those parents who are unwilling into the category of those parents who are willing and able to provide for their children. Okay, have the next slide. I want to walk you briefly through the child support program services. It starts when a case comes into our system, either through an application for services or a referral from a partner agency. And we receive cases from those temporary assistance for needy families, the Oregon Health Plan, the Oregon Youth Authority, foster care, employment-related daycare, and also from referrals from other states. If the location of the non-custodial parent is unknown, then we put the case into the locate process, and we access databases within the state of Oregon. We have connections with other states and also with the federal government. If the child or children were born out of wedlock, it's necessary to establish paternity before we can enter a child support obligation. This doesn't always require a legal process. In the state of Oregon, the child support program has worked very hard and effectively with hospitals and birthing centers throughout the state who work with parents to establish paternity through a very simple voluntary acknowledgement form. If paternity is not established voluntarily, then we will move to initiate a legal action to establish paternity, and for the most part, we use our administrative process to do that. In cases where we initiate legal action, we may also use DNA testing as part of the paternity determination. If paternity isn't an issue, or once we've established paternity, our case managers try to meet with the parents to determine the circumstances that are relevant to entering a child support order. We look at the finances, we look at the special needs that the children may have, we look at the special circumstances of the parents, and it's at that point, again, where we look to see if there are barriers that exist that may keep a parent from paying child support. And if there are, then we will make that referral to the partner, our partner agencies. We establish a child support order using child support guidelines to determine the amount of support. We also use the administrative process as opposed to using a judicial process in establishing the orders, because it's generally faster, it's less expensive, and it allows for an easier access for the customers into the system. Once an order is entered, we docket it with the court, and it becomes a court order. All of the support orders in the child support program are sent to a central office in Salem to be processed, and since 1993, all child support orders require that the child support payments be deducted from the wages with income withholding, kind of like a payroll deduction. If payments aren't received, We need to look at the case and may need to initiate enforcement action. And finally, those orders, once they are established, are periodically reviewed, and we look at them to make sure that they're still appropriate for the given circumstances. I want to talk a little about the enforcement tools that the Division of Child Support uses. The first one that I want to mention are financial institution garnishments. We initiate data matches with financial institutions within the state, and when we have a person who isn't paying support and we discover assets in one of those institutions, we will initiate a garnishment action. We have tax offsets. We intercept tax refunds both from state and the federal government. We place liens on properties, and we suspend licenses, both professional and occupational, driver's licenses and recreational licenses if the non-custodial parents are not paying. We intercept lottery winnings. We use judicial enforcement, which includes contempt actions and criminal non-support actions. And for those hard-to-work cases that involved another state, we initiate actions through the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. Now I'd like to move forward and share with you four of the performance measures that we use to measure the success of the child support program. The first measure is measure 137-10, and this indicates the success level in increasing the amount of support which is distributed to families, which helps them remain self-sufficient and less dependent on other government services. Support for children who are in the custody of the state or for children who are receiving assistance aren't included in this, but it's shown that over 90% of all support that was collected in 2001 and 2002 was distributed directly to the families. This year, we expect to distribute 90% of collections to the families, and we're projecting an increase of 91% for next biennium. The next performance measure, 137-11, reflects the percentage of court-ordered child support which is paid each month. This measure is also a federal performance measure, and you'll note that black line that says the federal benchmark. The Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement has set a baseline or a minimum standard of 40% for the states to meet. And achieving that baseline entitles the state to receive incentive monies from the federal government. The higher the performance over 40%, the more incentive monies the state is entitled to receive. On the other side of that, failure to reach that 40% benchmark subjects the state to a loss of the incentive monies and also to potential financial penalties from the federal government. As you can see from the chart, over 59% of current support was paid in the year 2001, 60.4% in 2002, and we're projecting 62% for biennium of 2003 to 2005. The next performance measure is 137-12, and that's really the other side of the collection piece. This measure shows the percentage of cases which have a collection on delinquent child support. This is also a federal performance measure. And over 56%, we met 56% in 2001, 61% in 2002, and we're projecting a gradual increase to 63% in 2005. The increase that we show from 2001 to 2002 is due to the enforcement tools that were granted by the 9901 legislature, especially the financial data match that I talked about, and to the fact that the Division of Child Support set up a small team of case managers to look and work the delinquency cases.
Mr. Chairman. Just had a question. In terms of payments to families, is there an offset in that in terms of like the payments that have been made to the families in terms of TANF, or is there no offset? When you say payments made directly to the families, is part of the cost of providing services, should they have been eligible because they're not receiving child support for the programs because their income level is at that level,
I'm just trying to understand how the system actually works in terms of the payments to the families. Is there an offset for services provided to the family at public expense? Or
Chair and Senator Devlin, let me say that we, on any case where there has been in the past any public assistance or any current public assistance cases, there is a distribution formula. Current support would go to the family, and it's a federal distribution formula, and we talk about zillion buckets that they all go into. But part of that is then once they're off of assistance, they get their current support, but we would eventually collect the amount that's assigned to us as the recovery for that time when they were on assistance. And if they're currently on public assistance, they assign their child support to the state. And so that does not go to the family.
One other question, if I can follow up, and I don't know if it's here in the coming slides. When you say approximately, you know, you're setting, I think, about a 61% compliance rate. What are we talking about in terms of broad dollars? I mean, what does that really reflect? And
Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, I think later in the presentation there is a slide that will show that we are projecting, I believe it's $605 million in collections for this biennium, and an increase to $612 million for next biennium.
So roughly there would be about $1 billion in collectible child support out there if you were collecting 100%. So, okay.
That is correct. Measure 13713 measures the child support program's success in establishing orders. And this measure, once again, is a federal performance measure that requires a minimum performance. And in this case, the federal benchmark is set at 50%. 66.7% of child support cases in the year 2001 had child support orders, 66.9% in 2002, and our target increases to 68% in the year 2005.
And the reason for this benchmark, what are you hoping, why are you targeting the percentage of support cases with orders?
Well, Mr. Chair, we believe that as a show in some later slides, the caseload is going to increase, and it increases both from cases that come into the system which have a pre-existing child support order, generally divorce decrees, and also in the work that we are doing with families to establish the child support orders. The work has changed over the years, as I've talked about, to one where we're meeting with families, we're trying to identify those barriers and refer them to services which will help us establish the orders in a more timely manner and in a more effective manner.
Mr. Chair, may I also add that the significance of this measure, all of these measures are federally required measures on which, as Mr. David referred to earlier, we get incentives if we're above the baseline, and the higher we are above the baseline, the more incentives we are entitled to. On that particular measure, if we don't have an order, nothing else happens. You don't collect any child support. And there are a lot of factors for why that number is only in the 60-some percent in terms of not being able to locate parents. That's one of the main factors. And so as we're going along and looking at how to improve the performance of the program and looking at the benefit to families, the higher percentage of orders we have in terms of the total number of cases that are referred or come to us on application, the higher probability there is we can get some money to those families.
Thank you. Starting on page 1-19, I'd like to talk a little about the program achievements. And the first one is that the child support collections continue to increase. And as I said earlier, we've projected collections of $605 million for the 2001-2003 biennium. And we are projecting a continued increase for next biennium due to the tools that we were given last legislative session. While the general, the total child support collections continue to rise, I do think that I need to point out that state recoveries, however, will continue their downward trend. And that's due to the phase-in of the distribution rules that were adopted as part of welfare reform, again, this federally mandated piece. And we project a 4.2% decrease in those recoveries. The next slide shows that for the 2002 state fiscal year, that those 91% of collections would be distributed to families, and 9% of it would be retained for the state and federal government. The next chart shows how those monies retained by the state are distributed. $14.9 million will be retained by Oregon, and that's $9.1 million to temporary assistance for needy families, $3.9 million for foster care, and $1.9 million for the Oregon Youth Authority. $13.2 million will be sent to the federal government as their return on the federal match. Another area of success has been in Oregon's success in establishing paternity for children who are born out of wedlock. This again is a federal mandate, and Oregon has been successful in meeting that mandate. We're projecting that we'll establish paternity for 91% of the children born out of wedlock in Oregon. This chart entitled Self-Assessment shows Oregon's performance in a variety of areas that have federal requirements. And most of these are around the area of time frames. The things that are included are case closure, disbursement, enforcement, establishment, you know, things like medical support. I talked about the time frames, and for instance, under disbursement, the federal government requires that in 75% of the cases, the child support that's received is receipted, put through the process, and disbursed to the family within 2 days of receipt. The federal government also requires that each state conduct internal audits to ensure that we're meeting those federal mandates. And while we're responsible for conducting the self-assessment, there are a number of cross-checks to ensure the accuracy of that, such as the data reliability audits and periodic reviews by the federal office. And as you can see from the chart, we meet or exceed all of the federal benchmarks. In the year 2000, that wasn't the case. In fact, we failed to meet the requirements in the establishment category. We only reached a performance level of 71%, while 75% is required. But as you can see, a year later, in 2001, we attained an 85% compliance rate in that category. The process plan that we developed and implemented was submitted as a best practice for other states to consider. The Division of Child Support implemented a web-based child support calculator to make the computation of child support easier and more available to the public. And this is a picture of that calculator. The calculator is used by the private bar, and it's also used by judges in the courtroom when they're computing child support awards. The calculator includes the ability to take into consideration the special needs of children that I talked about, as well as any special circumstances that may exist in the family. The calculator is available online to anyone who wants to use it, and it's used a lot. Over the last 6 months, we've had an average of over 81,000 hits each month to the child support calculator. We've included the website address in your materials if you'd like to take a look at that online. One other thing that is not in the material but I wanted to bring up as a success or achievement is that Oregon is one of only 20 states that have a federally certified child support computer system, which is also a federal mandate and was quite the job, but we have achieved that. We'll move to program trends. The first three trends that you see up there really pertain to customer service. Meeting the needs of low-income, non-custodial parents, I've talked about a little bit. But many of the non-custodial parents in our caseload are in the same economic situation as the custodial parents who are receiving assistance. Many lack the same job skills and have the same needs, and meeting those needs is an ongoing discussion on a national level. The child support program in Oregon recognizes the importance of assisting those parents within our ability to do so. We don't actually provide non-child support services to them, but again, we work within the local communities to identify and develop those collaborative partnerships where we can refer our customers.
One thing I'm trying to understand, and it came up in the Attorney General's broad presentation on this, is that you're directed to some degree at collecting child support for custodial parents that are receiving different types of aid, and that a custodial parent who's not receiving any aid, my understanding would be actually to some degree be getting assistance from their district attorneys, could be getting assistance. And I'm just wondering, that transition in a sense is that somebody that's having a problem collecting child support may not be receiving aid now, but because they're not receiving aid, or they're not receiving child support now, may end up ultimately getting assistance. How does that system really work in a sense? I mean, I can see why you have the federal dollars and why the federal role has evolved in the sense of if you have non-custodial parents not paying child support and the federal government having to pay the bill, and actually the state also, why you have that. But what real assistance do parents have? That's my basic question. What real assistance do parents have that are not receiving any federal assistance but are having problems getting child support collected from their non-custodial parent?
Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, the people who are not receiving state assistance have the same access to the child support program as those who are receiving assistance. That also is a federal mandate. The same services that are delivered on assistance cases be provided and available to citizens who need assistance in the enforcement and establishment of child support obligations.
So where does the role of the district attorneys come in? The only reason I'm asking this question, I think this might be, there's only 90 of us here in the building. I mean, 60 legislators and 30 senators. But it's probably one of the more common constituent issues that comes forward, and trying to understand the system gets to be really difficult, and who to talk to, whether you're talking on behalf of a custodial parent or on behalf of a non-custodial parent that's paying benefits, of trying to figure out the system.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, the child support program has tried very hard to ensure that if we have a contact from a citizen regarding their child support case, that whatever office they contact provides them with the information and assistance that they may need. The district attorneys work cases where there's never been any type of assistance provided to the family. The Division of Child Support works those cases when assistance has been provided, or is being provided and has been provided. Once a case enters the Division of Child Support system, it doesn't leave until the case is closed. There's no transfer between the programs. Also, we have within the Child Support Director's Office a constituent desk, which deals with child support issues, where the public can contact that particular desk to receive assistance, have questions answered on their particular case.
Okay. It took us, Mr. Chairman, it took us about 3 weeks one session to find that desk, you know, in calls to various agencies of trying to figure out a question. But once we found the desk, the issue was resolved fairly quickly. So
one of the things that we're also working on, and it will be a little, as I'm wrapping up, we are providing more and more information online. That particular telephone number and access can be found on our website, which wasn't there. I don't believe it was there last session.
Okay. Thank you.
Appropriate child support orders is another program trend. It's nationally recognized that more people pay their support when the amount that they're ordered to pay is appropriate to their circumstances. orders that consider the needs of the children and of the parents who are paying that support are most effective. And this requires a very high level of case management and customer contact, both of which are time-consuming tools. Increasing caseloads make this a little more difficult. Once orders are entered, as I talked about before, we also need to ensure that they stay appropriate, and so we are periodically needing to review those orders to ensure that they remain appropriate. The third customer service piece up there is the access to child support information and services that we were just talking about. As our society becomes more computer literate and computer dependent, expectations have grown for that electronic access to child support accounts, forms, information, and services, and we expect the need for that electronic access to continue growing. The program trend around security of information. The child support program is really very privileged to have access to a wide variety of databases which help us move quickly in locating parents and also in enforcing the child support obligations. However, ensuring the security of that information and ensuring that that information is used appropriately is requiring more resources than it has in the past. Potential caseload. If we could go to the next chart. This chart shows that the child support caseload is growing and continues to grow. And we've projected continued growth through 2005, and we look at a couple indicators of that potential growth, which is the next chart. Those indicators of potential growth are the numbers of children who were born out of wedlock and the number of divorces with minor children. And on this chart, you'll see that there is a gradual growth in that. The next chart shows the second indicator, which is the temporary assistance for needy families caseload. And as you can see, what was a relatively flat growth has recently started to increase. But even when the temporary assistance for needy families caseload remains flat, the child support caseload continues to grow, because every time a new case comes into the system, that case is going to stay with us until the child no longer is entitled to child support, which may be 18 or 21 years if the child goes on to college. Before Cindy starts the legislative proposal section of our presentation, I want to just take just a moment here to clarify something that I believe was said earlier in the week regarding child support. I know that we're to report on any audits that we may have received, and I believe it was mentioned that we had received the Secretary of State's audit. That Secretary of State's audit was actually finalized last biennium, and so we don't have anything to report. There have been no audits this biennium.
Mr. Chair and members, again, I'm Cindy Chinook, Director of the Child Support Program, and I'm going to quickly go through some of the most significant legislative proposals that are before this body this session, and then through the budget numbers. The first proposal that I want to talk about is House Bill 2340, which is the Child Support Program Consolidation, and you've heard about this a number of times already. But let me just say that this is a Judiciary Committee bill, and it's supported both by the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice. In fact, we worked together during the interim, following a budget note from last session, to determine the best way to approach this. And everyone is on board as far as the agencies. The Child Support Program consolidation, as Bob mentioned, started in 1997 at the request of our Attorney General, Hardy Myers, and this will complete that process. Earlier, you saw an organization chart that showed the current structure with Department of Human Services having the Child Support Director's Office and oversight of the program. And this chart that you're seeing now shows what the proposed consolidation, how it will change that, and it shows that the full program is within the Department of Justice, and also shows the importance that we will still have the partnership with our district attorneys in 28 counties. The next chart shows you the detail of the division, and the significant point I want to make on this is that we still will have the three sections, and as Bob described earlier, but you see a district attorney liaison position with a dashed line off to the side. That position exists currently and will be continued, and the person who is in that position reports regularly to the Oregon District Attorney Association Executive Committee and actually is an employee of Marion County, but is funded through the program, the state program. And as we have put this interagency team together for this transition year, that position is a critical position in the leadership of the program statewide and will continue to be part of the statewide leadership as we go forward. The next slide gives you a brief overview of the benefits. And I just want to say on the first item where it says streamlining decision-making, I really believe that this streamlines not only decision-making, overall administration. It's better government because it's getting rid of duplication between the two agencies. And a simple example of that is in the past, this budget would have been heard in two separate Ways and Means subcommittees with two separate legislative fiscal analysts and two separate budget and management analysts. And so that's an example of the duplication that occurred because of the structure of most of the program being in the Department of Justice, but the oversight and the responsibility to the federal government being in the Department of Human Services. So you had that duplication. And finally, on this point, I just want to say that this matches the program oversight policy setting and the operations with the accountability for our performance and budget. So as decisions are being made, you get the whole picture and consider all of the factors that need to be considered as you're making those broad decisions for the program. The second point is that it strengthens our district attorney partnership. We have a strong partnership with the district attorneys, and in addition to having the district attorney liaison position as part of the statewide leadership for this program, we also have a number of decision-making groups on which we have representatives from various counties, DA offices across the state, so that there's regular opportunity for them to be involved in decision-making and setting the direction for the program. In addition to that, I have met with several of the elected district attorneys, and we continue to meet with other elected district attorneys to ensure that we are hearing what their needs are and that as we're setting direction for the program overall, that those needs are being considered and their input is heard. So as we do this, the support for I would just say that initially, as we talked about consolidation, there was some concern among district attorneys about what that would mean for them. And I will tell you that from my discussions with individual district attorneys and with the district attorney liaison, we have strong support for the consolidation. And I think that also speaks to that sense that they do have an effective role in the program. Finally, it improves customer service. In the past, with two state agencies having some role in the program, some of the documents that went out to people with child support cases would have the DHS letterhead. Some would come from the Central Department of Justice or Division of Child Support. And there was a significant amount of confusion about, so who do I call anyway? And that may also have gone to the question that you asked earlier about, so who is ultimately, you know, if I've talked to the local folks and didn't get an answer, who do I go to next? We think this makes customer service much more clear and it will improve our customer service. The next bill.
I think it's worth noting with the consolidation that there are still two strong ties to DHS in the program. First of all, they are one of the partners in making that whole family holistic or whatever you want to call it view. They are a partner. The second one is a little more punitive in the sense that the major federal penalty for non-performance or not meeting or non-performance or whatever you want to call it is a reduction in the TANF grant, which is a primary funding source for the Department of Human Services. So there still is that strong link between the two departments. One a very positive one not so positive.
And I will say to that point that as we've gone through the whole planning of the consolidation, and we've got an oversight committee working on that. One of the key elements that we continue into the future is a child support steering committee that has broad representation not only of our partners in DHS but also Oregon Youth Authority and Judicial Department because of our interaction with the courts, so that we are, as we make any changes and we're talking about the overall performance, they have an opportunity to input to help us make those decisions. Okay, just three other bills that I want to mention to you. And each one of these is important in its own way. First of all, House Bill 2095 is the National Medical Support Notice. It is a federally mandated provision that we need to add to our law. And basically what it is requiring that any time we have a new hire report and there is a child support case, that we check to see if there's privately funded health insurance available, so that whenever possible you are finding that private health insurance for the children versus having to have publicly funded health insurance. And at the national level, that was, I mean, the two premises were children need to have health coverage, and the second is our Medicare, Medicaid costs are skyrocketing, and I've heard it described as the Pac-Man of public budget, that this may be one way of offsetting that increase is to find privately funded insurance for children in our caseload whenever it's available. And again, it is a federal mandate. If we do not adopt it, we will not have a qualified state plan. The second is House Bill 2112. This is Social Security numbers on driver's licenses. When we first adopted welfare reform and put our language together for the 1997 session of this body, the federal language was commercial driver's licenses, and then there were some changes. They dropped commercial. It was supposed to be all driver's licenses. What we had already actually in our law was commercial Social Security number on commercial driver's licenses. We now, this is a state plan compliance issue. If, in fact, we're already on notice that if we do not adopt this, our state plan will be disallowed. And with a state plan being disallowed, you lose all of the funding, the federal funding for the child support program, plus, as was mentioned earlier, the TANF block grant is in jeopardy because the TANF block grant requires the state to have a qualified child support plan. So we're going to be looking that one carefully.
Just clarification. The Social Security number is given on the application, on the license.
Yes, I'm sorry. That's a good clarification, Mr. Chair. It's on the application form. And Department of Motor Vehicles is quite concerned about not disclosing that information, but it will be used for our enforcement on license suspension program. Okay. And then the third one on this slide is House Bill 2113, which has to do with the confidentiality and partner access to child support program information. Bob mentioned earlier that we do have very strong confidentiality requirements. Some time ago, the federal government repealed a regulation for another reason, but it had the broader language that allowed us to share more information with our partners. And on the repeal of that, then, our law currently is too broad, and we need to correct that. And this, again, is a state plan compliance issue. So we'll be working on that. All right. Those are the legislative proposals, and now I'll go to the budget numbers. Go through this quickly and answer any questions you have. Keep in mind that the numbers that we're showing you include the consolidation. That's one of the policy packages. So the totals will include that transfer from DHS to the Department of Justice. And so some of the big increases you might see, I'll point those out as we go along, are primarily due to that proposal. The first slide shows you the revenues by source for this program. Of note is that general fund makes up only 10% of the funding for this program. The other fund portion is are the recoveries, and as we go through the consolidation, the recoveries for the TANF, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families Program, are retained in the Child Support Program to fund the Child Support Program. Recoveries for the children that are in the care and custody of the state, either foster care or Oregon Youth Authority, those monies actually go to those programs to become part of their budget. The second slide is one you've seen before. This just shows that 41% of the department's budget is child support. The next slide is the governor's balanced budget for the Division of Child Support, and most of the increase that you see there between the $78 million and the $112 million is, in fact, the transfer from DHS to DOJ. There are a couple of other increases in policy packages, which I will go over in a minute. The next slide shows the budget by category, and I just want to mention the special payments. That is the pass-through to the district attorneys of the federal match. And in fact, the slide just before this, you will see that in 9901 and 0103, there were zero special payments, and that jumps up to $15 million. And that's the match, the federal match, to the counties for their work in the child support program. Okay. Essential packages. As with other divisions, this is one we're not going to spend a lot of time on, and if you have questions, Frank Pecha would be available to talk with you about those. Just a note that, generally speaking, when you look at the dollars, only a portion of those dollars are general fund. In this case, about $387,000 are general fund. Now, the next slide are the House Bill 3182 reductions, and while we have identified reductions in accordance with the bill, these reductions are not part of the governor's balanced budget, so they're not reflected in the other numbers you see. The reductions that we have identified would be elimination of 19 child support specialists, and a reduction of the office specialist twos performing certain functions in the division. There are a variety of impacts, but at this point, let me just give you the big points. One is a general fund negative impact. From the first slide, you saw that the cut of a total of $8 million something is $880,000 general fund. With these reductions, we would actually lose, the state would lose $3 million in recoveries that are already included in the base budget as funding for the program. So there's a net of more than $2 million loss in the general fund category. So that's the negative general fund impact. The second that's listed is the family issue. This would also be a reduction of $30.7 million in collections for families. And many of those families, not all, but many of them are low-income working families that rely on the child support as an income support to keep them in that self-sufficiency state, if you will. And if they lose the child support, they are likely to seek other state assistance. So there's a cost avoidance there. And to the best of my knowledge, we aren't able to talk very succinctly about that cost that it might, not only do you lose the money in terms of collections that we would recover, but there might be an increased cost as they seek other assistance. And then finally,
While we're talking about negative impacts, how, if you had removed 19 people working on bringing revenue in, how would you triage? How would you actually work that cut? Stop. I wouldn't imagine you'd stop cases that were active. Would you stop? Put an embargo on accepting new cases for a while, or triage? How would you?
Mr. Chair, actually, we don't have the choice of not taking new cases under the federal guide. So what would happen is that everything would slow down. you would find that it would just take longer to get to each of the cases and to conduct the enforcement. And the likelihood is that those hardest to work cases where people are perhaps not employed, where they have a salary, where we can get to an income withholding, but it's going to require more investigation or more time, and they're hiding the money, that those cases would be the ones that, if you will, benefit, because we can't spend that increased amount of time to do the most difficult cases. So in terms of establishing the order, though, in the first place and locating the parents, we would have to continue to do that in order to meet the federal requirements in all cases. And then finally, and this sort of goes to that, if our performance decreases in any of the federally measured areas, and Bob went over many of those earlier, we stand to lose federal funds from incentives. If the performance drops at all, the incentives would drop. If we drop below the baseline, which was on all of those charts, then the incentive goes to zero for that category. And if you miss it in 2 years, two consecutive years, you not only lose the incentive, there's an additional penalty. So the loss of the positions could put us into that situation. Okay, policy packages. I've already talked about the House Bill Consolidation 2340. This policy package represents the fiscal impact of the transfer of the program from the Department of Human Services to the Department of Justice. There are three points I want to mention here, and they're just sort of a summary. DOJ assumes full responsibility for the program. It's a transfer of 9 positions from DHS to DOJ. And there's actually a positive general fund impact. And if you go to the next slide, it shows the cost or the transfer. And there's a note at the bottom that there's approximately 900,000 general fund savings with this transfer. And that's because of those efficiencies I mentioned earlier, getting rid of duplication of effort, and that we did not in the request for the transfer include all of the child support related positions and parts of positions in the transfer. For instance, there was a director, has always been a director in the Department of Human Services and an administrator in for DCS in the Department of Justice. And on this transfer, that person becomes this one position, not two. So that's an example of one of those savings. And you'll note there that while it's $21 million, $15 million are the pass-through of federal funds to the district attorneys. Policy package 201 continues the welfare reform positions that were included with the passage of welfare reform in 1997. It was adopted in 1997 with a 4-year sunset. So with that sunset, all of the positions that came along with the work, increased work requirement, were made limited duration positions. That work and those positions are still with us. They, in 99, the sunset was removed, but on an oversight, it didn't get a referral to Ways and Means to change those positions from limited duration to permanent positions. And so they've been continued as limited duration positions that have been funded, but it has created some issues for us, labor issues for us, in terms of trying to fill, you know, indefinite limited duration positions. And this policy package then would continue those positions, make them permanent, and there's actually a general fund, positive general fund impact. And that would be between, if the choice was continue them, make them permanent, or not approve this policy package at all, because these positions actually generate more general fund recoveries than are needed to fund the positions. Those recoveries are included in the governor's balanced budget, so they've already been factored in. But I just want to mention that. And you can see that it continues a number of positions, and the total is $1.8 million.
So do we have the opportunity
to even add more people there to accrue more general fund savings?
I think that, Mr. Chair, that any positions that are added, I don't know if it would go to these functions because they're fully covered right now in terms of new hire reporting. In terms of case management to do more enforcement, there is that possibility, and we haven't calculated that.
Can
we
give us some analysis on that?
Okay.
If you think that that additional positions may be able to help generate some more general fund revenue savings.
The last policy package speaks to that to some degree. This is policy package 205, and it relates to workload increase. You've seen from the earlier presentation that the caseload continues to increase. In addition to that, federal requirements about how we work each case and additional mandates about what we do with each case have increased the complexity of the work. So as the caseload increases and the complexity of those cases, working those cases increases, we are stretched to continue to meet our federal performance measures. This would add 5 positions for the second year of the biennium, and there's no general fund impact in terms of the funding of this package. These positions will generate sufficient recoveries to to meet the state state requirement, funding requirement. So this would be all other fund and federal funds. And in addition to that, it would generate $1.2 million for families.
Why are we adding these people only in the last half of the biennium?
Mr. Chair, it was I think in working with our analysts and so forth that just looking at the possibility of when that workload increase is going to be to the point where we just can't cover it. Now, if we added them earlier, they would be generating enough still general fund to cover their cost, plus the additional collections for families. We were trying to be conservative in the fact that, you know, adding positions sometimes, you know, in this fiscal environment is maybe asking a lot.
Kelly, you want to say something?
Mr. Chair, when these packages first came over, they had general fund attached to them, and that was one of the major reasons why we scaled it back. The standard we used for the transfer of the child support program is it would not cost any additional general fund. I think it would be a very good process to go through now that we have some sense of what the transfer is going to be to see if there's any efficiencies that can be gained later.
I'd like to go back and see if we can accrue some more general fund savings as a result of maximizing our collections efforts and keeping people accountable as they should be, especially in this budget environment. So if we can accomplish that, I'd be more than willing to take a look at that. So if you can get with Doug and talk with us a little bit more about that. My sense is we can help the citizens do the right thing and print some more general fund money, I'm happy to go there.
Okay. And that ends our presentation. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Mr. Mayor? Richard? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Evan.
Should be toward the back. I'm going to bring this thing so I can talk. Chair Patridge, members of the committee, I'm Frank Petch. I'm the Director of Admin Services for the Department of Justice, recovering from a cold.
We're glad to have you among the watchers today. The rumors have abounded in the building about how sick you were. So I was saying you were in for a half day or a few hours yesterday morning. We're getting sightings. So
that's right, that's right. And today all day.
All right.
As long as my voice holds out.
Well, if you pass out, we won't use the AED on you. You go
Well, I have with me today Nancy Minden from the Division of Child Support Assistant Administrator. She's also a member of the DOJIS Advisory Committee. I'm going to break our presentation up into two different parts. First, I'm just going to talk about admin in general, and then I'm going to go into the IS area. So on the next slide, you can see something that has already been placed before you already, the work chart showing how the Attorney General and the Attorney General staff and then admin services fits and then the various sections that are within admin. The next slide will detail for you the Office of the Attorney General, and this is something that Attorney General Myers had covered earlier, so I'm not going to spend any time here and going through any of that. On the next slide, we will talk a little bit about Admin Services Division and the purpose or mission of Admin Services for the Department of Justice is the administrative arm of the Attorney General and providing centralized business support to the agency. There are four primary areas in which we do this. Within admin services, we provide physical services, operations, human resources, and info services. I'm going to give you just kind of a, knowing that we're short on time, I'm going to move through these slides fairly quickly. The following slides will give some deep detail as to the function of these sections. Probably the largest of the areas is physical services. We have three main functions in this area. The first one of those is accounting, and just we have a list of various activities within that particular area. The normal things that you would typically see would be the accounts payable, the accounts receivable, sometimes payroll. We have moved payroll into this area, made it much more efficient. A number of other areas that we cover, statewide financial reporting, employee travel, because we do have quite a bit of travel within the agency of staff moving around, especially Division of Child Support and then attorneys. One of the areas that has generated travel, just as anecdotal information, is with the location of prisons around the state, it has actually increased the travel for attorneys because of having to go to the actual locations. Next area in fiscal services is that I'd like to talk about is legal services billings. This is where we prepare about $3 to $3.5 million in billings a month that go out to client agencies for work that's performed. We actually compile within this particular group about 33,000 to 40,000 actual entries of information from attorneys, investigators, paralegals throughout the legal services area, and that compiles into about $3.5 million worth of bills on a monthly basis, averaging. This area also has a strong emphasis on customer service and collection of accounts receivable in order to maintain the cash flow that we need to maintain to keep the legal services operation solvent. The third area of fiscal services is budgeting services. This is basically all the technical work that goes into budget development. It also produces management reports on budget activity, which is actually for the variety of programs that we have throughout the agency is kind of an ongoing, continual task that just never ends. And forecasting for those programs in terms of if they are self-funded, if they generate revenues through some type of fee or service or recovery, just what their forecast is for their future revenues for that particular biennium. As I added information for members of the committee that are not familiar with DOJ, DOJ went through a major budget restructure for the 9901 session. Prior to that point in time, the budget was basically in one, about two centralized large pots with very little information as far as divisional budget information. And now we have a very organized budget in terms of the budget information is very accurate for each specific division, and we provide that information to each division administrator on a monthly basis. The second area I would talk about would be operations. This, the primary responsibility, the one that seems to get the most action or activity here, is in facilities management. We have over 28 leased locations statewide. That's about 300,000 square feet. Only about 60,000 square feet of that is leased from the state of Oregon, mainly in the DOJ building and then in the Pendleton office building. The remainder of those of that space is at various locations around the state in 28. Operations also covers a variety of other services, most of which I'm sure you're very familiar with. One of the unusual ones for DOJ, I might point out, is library services. We fill over 6,000 orders for AG publications annually, and that would be for items like AG opinions and that kind of thing. So there's quite a bit of that happens. The next section I would cover fairly rapidly is human resources. Human resources basically has three union contracts that we work with. We have SEIU, we have the Attorneys Union, and we also have Criminal Investigator Union. So we have three different groups of folks there that we need to administer to. And HR also takes care of our safety and workers' compensation. The next slide I would like to move to is looking at our performance measure that administration is responsible for. This came out as a focus area in the last session, dealing with our accounts receivable and the accounts receivable collected within 30 days. Initially, at the end of the 01 session, we developed a goal of trying to bring our ARs up to collection of 75% within the first 30 days. We actually met that goal, and in, through this process in the for the 03 session of developing our performance measures, we raised the bar to 80%. So now we're showing.
Because Doug Wilson left DHS and came here, so it wasn't so much.
We won't talk about payment by DHS. But
there is another side of the story.
I don't think I get the conversation. I got to harass you a little bit.
As you can see by the graph we have up there, shows a steady progress towards the improving our ARs, and we keep raising the benchmark as we get there. Factors affecting service for Admin Services Division, I would say probably one of the key ingredients is continued growth in agency staff, and also not only growth in agency staff, but also growth in the number of programs. The legislature, especially in 01, added a number of specialized, very specific programs in the Criminal Justice Division. Each one of those has its own particular little twists and turns in how they it has to be dealt with. Coordination with other state agencies, coordination with the federal government, reports that need to go in, and sometimes contracts that we need to look at and negotiate. So there is a lot of additional activity that's occurred over the last couple of years. Changes in the number of facilities and locations. We've had, in the last biennium, 8 offices relocated or remodeled. We've had 7 locations established, and also an increase in reporting requirements for grants and federal oversight agencies.
Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, I would imagine that your child support stuff is your is the major part of your location piece, but can you talk about your physical space requirement maybe a little bit? I know you have various people all around Salem in various office buildings.
Chair Patridge, the physical space as far as Salem is concerned, we have 6 locations, if my counting is correct, around the Salem area itself. There are then a variety of sites that are located throughout the state. The Legal Services Division has sites primarily in Eugene, Salem, and Portland, where we maintain law offices there in a proximity to the court buildings, and that from my perspective as a fiscal person is very effective. I would have to ask either Nancy Minden from DHS is, or from DCS as an administrator, I'm sorry, or Cindy to speak to various locations around the state for Division of Child Support, but they do have a variety of locations.
I don't need to know all that. I'm just wondering in Salem, it seems like an awful big debt load and people running around in all different spaces. Have you done that analysis from building versus?
Yes. In fact, I've been working with DAS, DAS facilities. As a matter of fact, the space is a real strong premium.
You don't know the story.
Space is a very big premium, and we are currently looking at and working with Department Administrative Services Facilities Division on utilizing some space in the Commerce Building, which the current tenant will be moving to the North Mall Building. And this is all packaged together with renovation of the Justice Building, which is, I believe, in the DAS budget plan. It's very difficult for us. I was not involved with it, but I know that, I believe in the last session, there was the idea floated of a Justice Center. And I've been involved kind of on the grassroots level of trying to find space for the various components of the building, and believe me, I would very much like to get as many people in the same location as possible. But space is just real difficult to find, especially any kind of large space. You can find 10,000 square feet worth of space, it's not very difficult, but getting where you're looking for 30 or 40,000 square feet worth of space to bring and consolidate groups together, it's practically impossible to find that around the mall. And, of course, one of the key ingredients, especially with the legal divisions, is moving them out from the mall area. Sometimes you run into a counterproductivity problem where they're farther away from the clients. So we've had to, out of necessity, have these different locations that are spotted around the Salem area.
We can talk about this more, not at the hearing.
Okay. Moving on, I talked about the increase in existing and new programs. On the next slide, I've listed some of those programs that have come in to DOJ within the last biennium from the O1 session. Next slide talks about involvement in interagency and intergovernmental programs. We work closely with DAS in a number of areas, and as shown on this slide, there's a number of committees that we're involved in and a number of teams and projects that we get involved with and try and stay and take a very active role, in fact, a more active role, a proactive role, in being involved in what's happening in state government and the various practice areas that we have. Administrative Service Division revenue source is supported. We're supported by charges to the programs based on the usage of service. We've taken a model where we have centralized a lot of the financial accounting that goes on, and we have people that specialize in various program areas. We have, for instance, we have a position that works solely for Medicaid fraud. We have positions that are dedicated to do specific work for Division of Child Support. And this helps us to maintain accurate and timely records and become very efficient in terms of processing everything we need to do. Moving on to some of the financial information that's part of the budget presentation, you can see by the next pie chart that admin is approximately 4% of the overall expenditures for the agency. The next pie chart chart will show you that admin overall is about 86 FTE, with total expenses of about $12 million. The next pie chart will show.
Can we go back to the previous slide? Can you tell me? I'm looking at the balance, O103 LAB versus the governor's balanced budget. I mean, you drop. I don't know if you can even photocopy anything in the upcoming biennium. You drop from $2,649,000 down to $165,000. You drop your capital outlay to a third. Can you maybe expound upon that?
Chair Patridge, yes. Part of what you see there in the services and supplies, I would say that a large portion of that is dealt with by the fact that we have moved the state government service charge from being a centrally charged amount to the various divisions. We were able to do that because DAS was able to provide information to agencies within the last biennium on how to allocate those charges based on how the charges were actually occurring. That is the majority of the services and supplies. In capital outlay, there were a number of one-time costs or expenditures that we were allowed from the 01 session, and the result is those came out and were subtracted out of the governor's balanced budget. The next pie chart shows the percentage of breakdown and types of costs that we have in admin. Service and supplies is a very small amount. Capital outlay is only 2%. We are heavily invested in staff, which is 97%. Our essential package, 030, is basically broken down between $80,000 in inflationary costs and state government service charges, approximately $1.1 million.
And that is prior to the transfer to the divisions, right? That $1.1
yes,
million dollar
yes.
increase?
Mm-hmm. Use of funding from the 01 legislative session. The 01 session, we had a very similar package number, 111. We have placed staff in areas to support our county needs for child support, crime victims, and the legal programs as a result of the positions that we were giving during the prior legislative session. House Bill 3182 reductions. The reduction is $2,479 in general fund. This is a portion of the Attorney General's salary. The $1.2 million in other funds are would come out of administration in general. Of that $1.2, typically when you look at the billing rate, you would assume it's at 32%, so 32% of that would be general fund. That wouldn't be quite correct because we have a number of positions in the administration budget, especially in the fiscal area, that are dedicated to programs. And so those programs are funding those positions, and they're funding them with federal funds and other dedicated other funds at times. So if I were to just give you kind of my accountant's shot from the hip, it's more like about 20%.
Can we go back to maybe your 030 package for a second? I mm-hmm. State service charge increase. Dr. Grant, we're going back and forth. It looks like it's about a 20% increase. Can you account for why it would be that much?
The essential package.
Right.
The state government service charge, that 1.1 represents the entire increase in state government service charge for the agency. And then subsequent to 030, we had, I think it's an 060 package that took this amount and then distributes it out to the various divisions. But the agency overall received about a $1.1 million increase in state government service charges.
Excuse me. If your services and supplies, I was just looking at the 2001-03 LAB, which was on page 9 of what I have, which is what we just asked you about. You had $2,649,906, which was your services and supplies account. And then you
yes.
And then I asked what the 160, you dropped down to
165.
And the explanation was it was spread out to the various divisions because you had a formula by which DAS or BAM was able to give you that.
Right.
Then I'm going over to the 030 essential packages,
mm-hmm.
and you've got 1.142, which is a 50% increase, close to 50% increase in services, 40% increase. Is that about 40%?
Yeah. It's a larger.
In services and supplies, so I'm wondering.
That's right. Mr. Chair, if I understand your question, it's really the question about why did your state government service charges increase so much?
Right.
And I
asked the same question.
Well, I'm just wondering, sitting on the DAS committee, too, I'm wondering if it's the risk management piece, because the DA's went up really substantially.
Well, I don't think they're going up as nearly to the degree that the DA's are, but it's definitely, we no longer, we didn't have a workers' comp cost in the prior budget. We do now. It's a roll-up cost on positions. It's other liability charges related to tort. And I think uniform rent would be out of this equation. But I think...
Is there a reason, though, that this wasn't spread out?
It is spread out.
O3O package is spread out through the entire department?
Yeah. It is now. Historically, all the state government service charges would show up in administration.
Right, but this is the O3O package that we're looking at now is just in administration, or it's spread out through the entire department through administration?
It's spread out through the entire department.
Instead of having little policy packages in each little division, you put it all here, but then it's going to be spread out when we adopt
the budget. Mr. Chair, when you build the budget, you start with the old budget, 01, and then you add the essential packages, of which 030 is one. So that $1.1 million is for all the department's state government service charges. And then as you move down, a later package in that process then takes that... The base plus the 1.1 and spread it. So it's really a matter of just the sequence
right.
of things.
Well,
I'm just trying to figure out where we're going, because
child support then would have its own services and supplies number. I mean, because that would be a huge services and supplies hit.
Chair Patrick,
right. We would see that at the division level, right?
What you would see in each of the essential packages is one of the essential package amounts is actually the allocation of this $1.1 million plus the original amount that's already sitting in state government
services. So this $1.1 is passed down from, okay.
That's still, correct.
Mm-hmm. But it's still a lot, so.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
And it's not because of...
No, and Mr. Chair, you should...
It's not because of child support either.
No, Mr. Chair, you should see in a lot of the agencies, because of workers' comp costs and tort liability increases, that state government charges have increased substantially.
Well, I watched it on the other end, on the risk management side of it, so I'll watch it on this. I think we're... Is this all... Do you want to finish through your packages, and then we'll do IT tomorrow?
To move forward, essentially, we'll start with policy packages. That's the last item to cover. We have one policy package, again, policy package 111. This is in the governor's balanced budget, and it's to provide accounting payroll support to the agency. The majority of the cost, we realized early on that the budget was going to be fairly constricted, and we worked with budget management to draft a policy package that we felt would be either no cost or very minimal cost. We are self-funding a number of the positions that are in the policy package through just looking internally within the division to look for other resources so that we can provide the service all of the people power, you might say, and looking for ways that we can cut our own costs so that we can provide that service level and still stay within our budget. One of the few positions that increases our cost is the supervising accounting technician payroll and benefits. We've had to do that because we have such a large group of folks. We have about 1,200 people for payroll. We have two people in payroll. It's very difficult to get really skilled folks. We've had to add one supervising technician, and that would just stabilize the program. We did this after discussion with DAS and specifically the State Controller's Division, which supported this particular position and advised us to move this direction. The following slide will show you a little historical growth in accounting transactions. And you can see that in this following slide that we continue as an agency, especially, and you might ask why is this occurring? A lot of this occurs because in the About a dozen slides previously, I had shown you the group of additional programs that the department has gained over time, especially during the O1 session. For each one of those programs, there's always a separate entry for everything that occurs, and that just increases the amount of activity accounting-wise that occurs overall. To wrap up, what I would cover would be the budget notes, and we had approximately three budget areas that we needed to report on. One of them was the implementation of our legal services retainer and whether there was any difficulty with that. I'm happy to report that that is working very well. We are on a real good rapport situation with our client agencies. We are receiving the funding and the payment for bills quickly, and that is working out extremely well. The question is, the second part was to evaluate whether we wanted to retain that for the coming 03-05 biennia, was one of the questions brought forward from the 01 session. We are recommending continuation of the retainer. It seems to work out well for clients. That works out very well for maintaining our cash balance and minimizes the impact on the rate, was the reason that we implemented it to start with. So it's been very successful. Also, we received a budget instruction to track separately the 0103 hardware and software expenses and provide some detailed reporting. I'm happy to report that we have been maintaining that, and we have reports of our expenditure history through 12/31 available if you'd care to see that. And that covers the end of my admin services presentation.
The only thing that I'm sorry that I missed the child support portion, and I tried to go back through the slides real quick just to thumb through them. I'd be interested in the organizational structure and by FTE level as to what it was at DHS and then what it looks like today as you've moved it over to look at where the FTEs are and what's going on in the child support division. But I know that you have the one package, I think, for nine positions, little package for nine positions. But I'm interested if you kind of give me the whole what it looked like in DHS versus what it looks like now in DOJ, so we can get an idea of comparing apples to apples. Okay. Any further questions?
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, we arranged to re-show the slides to you immediately following the regular.
Can you just burn them onto a DVD, and I'll watch them on my way down south this morning. I appreciate it. We'll do information systems piece tomorrow. We're also
critical
victims assistance tomorrow.
And
then we'll do public testimony tomorrow. So if you have anyone that has nice things to say about you, let them know. We have people that have bad things to say about you, let them know. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate you starting late and staying late.
We're adjourned.
Chair, we have an initial setup.